spell bonded. Gee, I need to make an alcoholic. And I'm going to have a look around and see who's here first. Because I might tell some lies about somebody. And I think I'll be safe. I won't be because my wife's here as well tonight. And she's here to take control. And I don't tell too many lies. But anyway, we look around the room and my wife's not an alcoholic. You know, I don't express it when I first come to AA. If you can't smell them, you can't tell them. And it's so true. But if you spend a bit of time with an alcoholic, maybe a minute, you find out that it's soon enough whether they are or not. And I'm not talking about drinking. I'm talking about certain characteristics. And I fall into the category of an alcoholic because I have certain characteristics. They're not exactly the same as anybody else, but there's certainly, I've identified a lot of them with so many people. I just celebrated 30 years in February, on February the 5th. And if you'd have told me when I come in here at 34 that I'd be 65, talking to people in AA, I said, well, no, the bullshit that is. I just would never believe it. So anybody, no matter how old they are, you know, this thing that's been going through my mind today is a vision for you. It certainly has been for me, this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, up to now. It hasn't been plain sailing, but why should it be? I don't look for it. It's certainly been a lot better than when I was drinking. A lot better. But I jump about all over the place. I might go from the age of 2 to 28 and then back to 5. But bear with me. It's not to do with alcoholism, it's just me. I'm actually from Wales. And the reason I mention that, it caused some problems in my life, really, identity wise, because all my family were from North Wales, which they talk a big different language. I suppose too many or some people don't know the geography, but it's a different country, if you like. Their first language is Welsh, and I was 5 when they took me down to the south of England. I was brought up 60 miles east of London, just off the coast of France, at least 22 miles in France. And in a Welsh mining community, all coal miners. Wales was predominantly known for coal mines. And my uncles walked down from South Wales across to the Kent coalfields. I was from the county of Kent, I was brought up. And, you know, the reason I mention those is because they had a big part in my life. I wanted to be like them, even from the age of, as far back as I can remember, swinging on the railings. I remember this one pub, the Windmill pub, swinging on the railings, listening to these uncles singing their heads off on a Friday night, Saturday night. Now, people never used to turn up and clear off. They used to shout out requests out the bedroom window. They were that good. The Welsh were known for singing. Give it big clicks. And I wanted to be like them. Only one of those uncles turned out to be alcoholic. The rest were all steady people. But they really set the... They were just a normal thing to do in the way that I was brought up. In a council house, which is a state run. Houses. The reason my father went down to Kent, because just after the war there was plenty of houses, a lot of them were bombed out, so you could take your pick. And that's why he went down there. And there was work, and he actually worked for American Air Base. 3 miles out of town was an American Air Base. The biggest one in Great Britain, because it was the closest, it was the closest to Europe. That could get some quicker and bomb them. No, that's the idea. It doesn't stir that trouble. So I was brought up with a lot of Americans around me. And I remember in particular, I'm going to say it anyway, but I've seen the difference between the colours at a very early age. And it shocked me, even at probably the 10-year-old, watching MPs, 6 foot and plus, smacking out at the fellas, one guy in particular had a knife sticking out the back of his neck, and then dragging him to the back of the Jeep, cutting off down the road. He was dead. They were white. 10 years later, I ended up on a job, or 11 years later, I ended up in West Africa. An open cast iron ore mine. Drunk as a skunk, because I had a problem from the age of 14, really, the first big blackout. Where I'd done damage to myself, other people's property, and swore I'd never do it again, at least not for 2 days. And that's what I've done. But, you know, I ended up saying that I wouldn't treat anyone the way that I'd seen people being treated. The same as I swore I'd never treat my children, if I ever had any, and a wife, the way that my neighbour treated his wife and kids. I'd done those things. I'd done the opposite of what I wanted to do, really. I'm certainly not proud of it. I'm certainly not ashamed of it too much. The things that I've done, the way that this disease of selfishness is 100% selfish for me. The way that I treated them, my first wife, the two children when I did eventually get them. My mother, who died in a mental hospital. And I always like to remember, you know, when I come to a meeting there. My mother died in a mental hospital and I got barred out. I was barred from visiting. I wasn't a patient, I was a visitor. And yet there was nothing wrong with me. I was sane. Of course, I'd gone there drunk and singing and shouting and all the rest of it. But it's ironic that the last drink I had, after coming to AA for a little while, not even thinking about sobriety, I couldn't visualise, as it says in the big book, a life without drink. So it never entered my head to stop drinking. But that same meeting I went back to in a blackout, I tried to get in this nut house. And they sent me to the pub. The last drink I had was in a pub called the Fag Arms. Yeah, and it means something different over there. A fag is a hayrick. I used to stand up and dry the straw out before they thatched the roof. And of course, the pubs over there were there for a reason, for the farm workers to refresh themselves. That was the Fag Arms. But I remember a sea of faces. Lost souls, expression, I heard in AA. And I seen these faces in this grey out, wasn't a black out, I can just see them. And you know, years later, those people were still in that nut house. Still in that nut house. They got into that trap of being taken care of, I suppose. Getting the drugs. I don't quite love it for drugs. I do not call myself an addict. No need to, personally. I've done an awful lot of drugs. LSD in particular. A lot of acid. And particularly amphetamine. I've been known as Mick the Trip. And a few other things. But, you know, from the word go, I just wanted to be out of the way that I felt. If I felt good, I wanted to feel better. And I couldn't stand feeling bad. So I just used whatever was available. You know, I felt as though I didn't belong down in Kent. I spoke the wrong language. I didn't belong in North Wales because I couldn't speak the language up there with my cousins and family up there. And I've always been close to that family, still am today. And so it was one of the traits of my life, I suppose. Not belonging. Didn't feel I belonged anywhere. I was living out of a suitcase. My mother was mentally ill. My father was actually killed when I was 10 years old in a road accident. My mother had a mental breakdown and she was never well. But from what I can gather, she wasn't too well prior to that, mentally. But that was the thing that flipped her over the edge. So in those days, I was 10 years old. I should have really been in a care. So really, I had a marvellous childhood because I'd done what I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, and how I wanted to do it. And I mean that. It was an awful lot of things. If they moved, they were mine. If they didn't move, they belonged to me as well. You know, oh, dear me. And I was forever wrecking things. It wasn't just me. The people I went about with, a couple of the other people had a chip on their shoulder, the same as I had. Kids that I knew. It was wrecking everything. It was just after the war, where they bombed out buildings that were going into and pull them down a little bit further. And do all sorts of weird and nasty things. But I didn't feel anything bad about it because everyone was doing it. It appeared that way. But when I look back, they weren't. There was only a few people that were doing it, one or two. Others were studious. I was certainly never studious. The only thing I've ever done religiously is attend Alcoholics Anonymous and perhaps go to the bathroom. But that's about the strength of it. But my character was formed, I'm completely sure, before I ever took a drink. As it says in the big book, this drink took over. And whatever problems I had, it made them bigger. Much bigger. And I just run through everybody's life. My own included, of course, I didn't realise that. I didn't look for anything other than money. And the only thing I needed money for was to drink. It wasn't just the drink, it was the trimmings to go with it. It was the cab's ear and this, that, flash alley, you know. Can you all see me behind here? Can you hear me? I know. Nobody can understand me. And those that can't, you think how I feel. There's only, because one of me, there's been no one you have to put up me all day. Your accents. But, you know, you people ruined this language. You've bloody ruined it. Absolutely ruined it. Good means bad, where are you? Oh, man. I've been here 8 years and I'm still getting the grips of this language. And it keeps changing everyone anyway, because you meet people from different places and the terminologies are different anyway. But Great Britain is exactly the same, in some respects. But I've gotten used to them. I know all the different lingos. Because as I said, I lived out of a suitcase. If I had a suitcase from the age of 15, just wandered about, earning money, living off my wits. Always good at what I had to do. And I say that, and I mean it, had to do. To earn the money to get the drink. I never once saved a penny for the kids' shoes, the rent, the utilities, nothing. Never done it. The only thing I was interested in was the next drink. I was never bothered about the one I had in front of me. It was the next one. It never keep me happy. But anyway, at 15 I was courting a young girl. We eventually married. In those days you had to get married, you know. Well, you didn't have to get married, of course. I think she was pregnant. Yeah. Surprised. But that son now is, I'm not sure, how old is he? 44, isn't he? Yeah, he's 44. And he's in England. I've got another daughter, 34. We've got Sandy and myself. We've got two sons. One's 22 and the other one's 25. Tony, our eldest son over here, he's just got about 16 months sobriety. And I tell you what, it reminds me so much of me. He's still as crazy as... Well, sorry? Mm-hmm. Yeah, me. Thank you, Brian. But he's doing exactly what the peer what I done. I threw myself into this fellowship. I certainly didn't and I've never suggested to anyone to do 90 meetings in 90 days. That's not my experience. You couldn't do 90 meetings in 90 days. If you might do if you had a plane, but that's about all. And a lot of money to travel around. Because when I got sober, there wasn't that many meetings around. And you know what? The quality of meetings were, I would say, and I mean it, were different. People looked after the meetings. Because if you didn't look after the meeting, you didn't have a meeting. Simple as that. Now there's meetings here, meetings there, you've got a big book. Same over there. The area where I got sober in Kent, I think there were six meetings when I got sober. when Sandy myself left there, that was 79. By 86 we moved north. I think there was 26 meetings. I don't know if I'm pleased to say it. With four of those I started myself. And Sandy started the other one as well. I was involved, threw myself into it. And I got into service. I jumped about, I even got sober again. I think I was sober. I know I was. Well, I didn't know actually, I didn't know I was sober. I didn't know what sobriety was when I came into AA. I didn't know that you people were talking about a mental attitude, if you like, as opposed to not taking a drink. I had to learn those things, find out for myself. I stayed around long enough to find out that the drink is, as it says, just a symptom of other problems. And these steps, and for me the traditions as well, and all the other things that come after them, or maybe before them, the realities, and they're there to help me enhance my sobriety. And the way I enhance it isn't by working on me. It's working with other people, in trying to help other people. I can't say I've ever helped anyone. I certainly never helped a son. We left him in prison when he got a DUI, and then I helped him there. I helped myself. Yeah, to help other people. So I suggest to anyone, get involved. Get into the service in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, it's a fact that there's less people coming to AA now than there was 20 years ago. Scares me to some extent. Not for me. I ain't got that much longer, I guess. But what about the people that are coming? I've stayed sober long enough to see certain changes in AA that I'm very happy about. And other things I'm not very happy about. But that's me. But I've got to tell you as I see it. Maybe with me just pushing foot in the ground. As far as I'm concerned, I've seen AA getting diluted in certain areas. And of course, if you dilute anything, it gets weaker. And I don't know at what point it stops working. But it must be a fact, as far as I'm concerned, that if it stopped working, if the numbers have dropped in the last 20 years in Great Britain, and here in Canada, then something's not working. I've not seen many people talk about it. But maybe let's call this not a public meeting, but they don't talk about it. And yet I talk to a lot of old timers who have been around a few years, and they all seem to have the same ideas, but they won't cross them. And I wonder why. I wonder why at times. I said to Tim, I hope I'm not too controversial because I get into it. And the reason I get into it, I think, I hope, is because I love AA. It saved my life. It gave me a life. And it's keeping me alive today. I've stayed sober long enough to get grey hair. I never had a grey hair on there when I got sober. Lost a few teeth. One or two problems. I'm waiting for open heart surgery in a month. And the good thing about that is I found out I've got a fucking heart. I mean, a heart. Sorry. I swore I wouldn't swear in a month. But this amazing fellowship of people from all walks of life that I've met from all walks of life, different colours, creeds. I sponsored different people with different religions. I sponsor an atheist, and all these so-called people I sponsor, or sponsored, they sponsored me. It's a two-way thing. The one guy in particular who's been over, we've been here 8 years now, he's been over, I think, 10, maybe 12 times since we've been here. Steve, his name is, he's 17 years sober now. And of course, when we got together, it was like that. I was up here, and he was down here. Now it's like that. We're co-sponsors now. And it's a marvellous thing, the friendships that I've made and attained and retained in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's still a long way to go. I can't, the bit that Tim read out, I can't remember it. It went, but you know, I can't give up on this thing. It's just because I'm 30 years sober. Do you know what? The only thing that tells me is that I know exactly when I had my last drink. It doesn't tell me anything else. If you want to know how sober I am, ask Sandy, my wife. No, don't ask her now, for Christ's sake. But ask the people around me, I would say, the people I work with at different times, not in 2 minutes or at meetings, that's a load of old rubbish. I can walk in those rooms and put a different face on them, be a different person. But in the home and whatever, that's where the sobriety is. Well, that's where you'll see my sobriety. And I've got to say, I'm sure Sandy wakes up, or when she's awaking, and says, there's no way that he's sober. But I accept that. Because I've never strived to be perfect. I certainly haven't made it. I settled for what I call this slow, well, I don't call it a slow spiritual progress in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't, never to remember page 153 of the big book, 278 or whatever. I'm not one of those individuals. But I've read it, and I understand it, and I read it, and I understand it. I'm not studious, I can't retain it. But when I need whatever I need at any given time, it's there, it would appear, because I needed to take a drink. And things are happening to me and in our life that in AA that would have blown me away prior to AA. They wouldn't have happened anyway. There's no way ever going to happen. But I've been able to handle them. And my wife's been a regular attender at Eleanor, and I recommend that for anybody, because I'm not sure whether I'd be here tonight if it wasn't for Eleanor. Sandy has an amazing way of letting me do what I have to do. I'm probably not as good at doing it the other way around. And as our old, my old sponsor and his wife, Sandy's sponsor, used to say, I used to say, where's Tony? Tony was my sponsor, Tarmac Tony. She used to say in a German-Irish accent, I don't know, she said, I only married him, I do not own him. And it's a fact. You see, I still try to own my wife. I try to own my kids. Do this, do that. Do the other. So I haven't worked these steps as good as some people. But I must have, as I said earlier, worked them just enough to stay sober. I don't feel under threat by any drink, by any particular problem. Only the small ones that would appear. Because big problems, what appear to be big problems, they never faze me anyway. Ah, so what? But the little ones, let them build up. I've heard it so often. Let the little ones build up, and then I'm in trouble. But I haven't stayed away from AA or AA people long enough for things to build up. I met somebody Thursday night who brought literally a tear to my eye. And I've asked him tonight, is it alright if I mention you? And he said, first of all, he said no, a very private individual, but then he said yes. And it's just his heart. And that's Fred there. A sober, 83 years old. And that brought a tear to my eye, I tell you. 83. Marvellous. And why not? He's the oldest person I've known to get surprising. 79, I think. Now the first meetings I attended in Canterbury, England, there were 3 doctors in the meeting. 2 of them went on to die of alcoholism. So I thought, well, they can't friggin' help, can they, these doctors? the other one was as good as gold, Conrad. And got to know him very well. He was 79 when he got sober. He got married to an AA girl. She was young bird. She was 56, an Irish nurse. And he called me one Sunday, he said, that's probably 2 years sober. And he spoke with a very, very eloquent accent. He was smoking a cigarette with a cigarette holder. And for those who remember Terry Thomas, an old British actor, he's the same as anyone. He said, how are you doing, Mickey? What are you up to today? I don't know what I said, but so what are you going to do? He said, well, Brendan and myself are going down to Beachy Head. That was a drive of about 150 miles. And this is his exact words, not mine. He said, we're going to have a fuck on Beachy Head. So that was 79. when he came in, sorry, he couldn't walk about 100 yards from the park to his house in this little town. He used to get a taxi. And he was going to walk up mountains and doing all sorts of stuff. Him and Sugar Bill, that's another old character. I've got to remember these old characters. These are the old boys that are around. And I got there. Sugar Bill. There was a big sugar strike in Great Britain. I think it was 1968, 69. And Bill had a big... he had a load of sugar anyway. And he kept the whole of the meeting going in the whole county with sugar. And his nickname was Sugar Bill. He'd drive all over the country, give the sugar out to the meetings. But the one-legged stand, and there were so many different characters. The one in particular was Tarmac Tony, my sponsor. He's been dead 15 years now. I see him every day because he's in my bedroom, or in the living room. And he's in the bedroom, actually. And what a character. What a friend. And that was a sponsor for me. I didn't need anyone kicking my ass saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. That isn't my experience. That isn't how I work sponsorship. No, Tony told me his story. Stories. Hundreds of them. I thought, oh, I'm not as bad as that. But you know what? He used to shut me up. I go, oh yeah, but tell you how it is. It's not your fucking turn yet. You'll have plenty of time. Not yet. He used to shut me up. And he done right. I've never shut up since. But what a character. A friend. He told me exactly how it was. He knew me inside out. And you know what? Before he died, I knew him inside out. He told me he had all these certain character defects. And he was 30 years sober. And he went across back to Ireland, he lost all his money. He went back to Ireland, he died over there peacefully. I went over to the funeral. I've never done such a happy funeral in all my life. Too long a story to tell you, there's things happening in that funeral. And he was just not believed. But it was so funny. And Tony was certainly there with us. A big gang of us in this wake. There's Tony in the middle, and all stood round with these AA members. All the pallbearers in this little village were all AA members. The drivers, the bloody grave diggers. And he told them at a funeral a few weeks prior, why don't you people brighten yourself up a bit, wearing all black suits and everything? Well, they all stood there with big kipper ties on and big flash. But it was in Barbados. Anyway, you know, I can't begin to tell it. I'm just thinking of so many different people I've met from, you know, all over. Great people. You know, some of them have gone back to drink. Some have got too well. Yeah, that's the way to put it, I suppose. Too well. See, the first time I come and say, as I said, I never had any intention of staying sober. But I didn't know what sobriety was. And I couldn't imagine that life without it. And so I didn't go for it. But what happened? Why did it just go click? Why is it I made a phone call in that nut house? I don't remember. And someone was coming to pick me up, which they did. Why is it Tuesday night and there was a meeting 20 miles down the road? in a little church hall that I attended a year before or whatever it was. And I got to that meeting in the blackout. I don't remember being in the meeting. I remember coming out. What happened? There's got to be a higher power. Something must have said, you ain't going to do it on your own. I'm going to help you. Boom. And there I was. From that second, whatever that second was, I haven't wanted to take a drink from that day with this. And I can assure you, I live for drink. We lived on a boat the last 5 years of my drinking, Sandy and myself. The reason for that romantic episode that would appear was the cheapest form of frigging living. That's all it was. Paying something like equivalent to $2 a week rent. It had no electricity, it had no, as you call it, utilities. So there was no quills, that was the idea. Well, I got sober, 4 years, I owed 4 years' rent. The only pound that was $15 a week. Well, I couldn't afford that. Well, I could spend $100 a week, I'm going back then, $400 now probably, on the drink. And that's all I've done. The boat was just done, I never paid for it until I got sober. Sandy's dad, I borrowed the money off him. And I got sober within no time at all, it was paid for. The boat got sold. I had 10 times more than the bloody paid for it. Now it never got wrecked, I've no idea. And Sandy had to go down those steps, she didn't swim then and she doesn't swim now. She had a fear of water. Still has got it. And yet, she was crazy enough to live on that boat. A fast flowing river, tidal river, went up and down 12 feet. A moor in the spring tides. Fetch and carry the water. I remember looking down over the boat, over the quay and saying, why don't you throw them frigging bottles away? Scruffy cow. They were my bottles. But why don't you throw them away? Anyway, we landed up. At one stage, we built a house on the top of the hill, and I got a bricklayer. I knew he was out, but he wasn't in the fellowship. He needed to be. And you know, it's all about dependent. He didn't have any teeth. What was his name? Jimmy Wilde. Jimmy Wilde. When I'd done the deal, I didn't realise that I could pick him up every day, fetch him to work. But he was a bricklayer. I wanted to do this house, a particular old style of bricklaying. And he's very good. So I went to pick him up this morning. We're coming up the track to this house where we're doing the building. And he said, oh, bleeding hell. She's only forgot my teeth again. It's all about dependent. And you know, it struck me straight away. Oh, he was just like me. She's forgot to put his teeth in. Yeah. I was at a meeting, or I've been, you know, I was 5, maybe 18 months so. And I heard a guy speak in a meeting. Let me take a drink here. Drop a gin now. I heard this guy saying that he was from South Africa. And he got out for a drink in Johannesburg. And landed up in either Sydney, Australia, or somewhere in Australia. Didn't think too much about it. And then it struck me. A couple of days, maybe a couple of weeks later. I got on a train in a little town where I was brought up, Ramsgate, to go to London, which was 60 miles up. Up the road. I knew everyone on the train. I could drink on that train. I knew everyone. Didn't need to go in the bars. It was the end of the line where I was brought up. Knew them all. Don't remember going up to London. Don't remember being. The only thing I vaguely recollect is being in a nightclub. This fellow with a big top hat was going to break my head open if I didn't give him all this money. But the bottle of, it was funny enough, it was gin that reminded me, a bottle of gin that I drank, a whole bottle. It was so much a nip, 32 nips. and it was £32. The average wages are £8 then. But I landed up flying out to West Africa. Don't remember the flight. I borrowed more money on that plane, and it was a 8-hour trip apparently, than most people earn in a bleeding month. And I come out of the blackout in the back of a Land Rover in the bush with they'd give us a travel kit allowance, but I'd drunk it. I didn't go and get shorts and short sleeve shirts and everything. I got them made out there for nothing by these people out there. But I woke up with winter attire on in the tropics. Man, this is hot. What's going on here? I was out in the bleeding bush. Baboons flying about. What's going on? And that was my life. I mean, prior to that, I'd gone on a ship at one stage. I joined the British Merchant Navy. I'd been in heavy steel construction prior to that. I had his Beamer bonnet because one of my old drinking buddies, he's long dead now, he died alcoholic. His heart blew up. He was a seaman. And most of the people around where I was brought up, they went to sea. And they had a lot of stories. I wanted to be able to tell the stories. When I come back after 6 months, I had more stories than all of them put together, it would appear. Because I was done before the ship. It was a world cruise. I don't remember setting off. I don't remember when it was in Great Britain, going from one end to the other to get a refit. I broke into the lifeboats and I stashed all the drugs. And they sent me around the world, literally. I also broke into one of these big safety doors so I could get to the passengers, because it was 1,000 passengers and 2,000 crew. That's sorry, that way around. The big liner. So I had free access. Both of those were civil offences. We got a lot of time in prison for both of those offences. And I didn't share any of those drugs going around at my life. That I remember. And I landed up seeing, I don't remember seeing relatives in New Zealand. I don't remember being in South Africa. Durban, Cape Town, Australia, Fremantle, Sydney, Melbourne. And yet I can remember the itinerary as if it was yesterday. Lost Palms, very remember. Being brought to the ship, getting fined for having women in the cabin, and then being asked, what cabin are they in? No, this is one of them. No, all sorts of weird and wonderful things went on. And you know, while that was going on, I had two children, or didn't have one child then. And a wife back in England. And I never thought of them. The only time my first wife got any money from me, because the shipping company allotted her so much a week, I couldn't get my hands on it. It was sent straight to her. She got a message, Christmas Eve, a telegram, saying that my full name is Michael Pugh Roberts, actually. British seaman, lost at sea. She thought I was dead. It should have been missing at sea, or missing on land, because I got to Acapulco and missed the ship. Didn't go back on it. But she had to put up with that until I eventually come home. I don't know to this day, I think it was about 10 days later I managed to get home. They threw us back. It was fine, it was missed the ship. One of them has never been seen from that day to this, in Acapulco. All these romantic, you know, crazy stories to tell the guys in the pubs. I could go on forever about those things, but I'm not going to. I've gone on long enough about all that. But how do you get onto this program? What's the program? Well, to me, the program is, the word's too big, it's too confusing, it's a way of life. And it, for me, it's very simple to understand a way of life. To try and do the things. I'm going to give something away now that I've done yesterday. I'm going to lose her. I pressure washed my neighbour's yard yesterday. He's a good old redneck. See, I'm a greyneck. That's a redneck without the sun. But I've done it because I thought, I'd love someone to come and pressure wash my bleeding yard. I'm very pleased about that. As far as I'm concerned, that's working the program. Trying to do something for somebody else, not just our colleagues. Doesn't matter who it is. And I've been able to do certain things. But you know what? I've had far more done for me. I don't know, I couldn't repay the things that people have done for me over the time I've been sober. Or even before I got sober. Because it was always happening. But I didn't see it. I couldn't see it then. I can see it now. What time is it? 10 o'clock. Not bad. I said to Tim, I'll probably drive after 3 hours. I'm bloody near dead now, but never mind. You know, the old things are still more as important today as ever. Talking to other people. Sponsorship. Don't, you know, I've met people that have managed to get good sobriety and keep good sobriety without a sponsor. So dear. But because I had such a marvellous experience with sponsorship, I wouldn't want to miss it. Why would I want to miss it? I had a guy spent 30 years sober. He was actually 30 years sober that day. It was 28 years ago. He said, phone? He said, I've never had a phone. I could see him as if it was yesterday. This is in an auditorium in Canterbury University. We were big shots in that age. And it was the first convention we had in the area. I was part of the organisation. And we had this great, great auditorium. Only about 2,000. There was about 50 of us. But he's there. Oh, I'll figure that, I'll tell you about that. he said, I've never had a phone. Don't go in pubs. He said, I'm going to live it. He played the drums in pubs. And he was still doing it last time I saw him. He's probably 48 years sober now, I should think so. Sponsorship, what's one of them? It would appear he's gone all against the suggestions. He'd done it his way, and he was a very happy guy, lovely fellow. But I had a lovely sponsor. A friend, a father figure that I never had. And yet we were equal at the same time. And I talked to Tony regularly. Why shouldn't I? Tarmac Tony. Great fun we had. But don't miss out. Get that little pamphlet that's knocking about on sponsorship. Read it. The first sponsor I had, I never asked him to sponsor me. It tells me in that pamphlet. You ask someone. If you don't ask them, they're not your sponsor. I don't know about that. Canadian John, he took me under his wing. And he said to me, he taught me a very valuable lesson. If you're going to say something, do it. And he said, if Maggie Thatcher gets into power, I'm leaving the country. I haven't seen him from, Maggie Thatcher got into power that day, and he left the country. I haven't seen him since. marvellous fellow. But he had a load of stories to tell. He was the 12-stepper, I tell you. He'd get his cell. He was salmon fishing off the west coast of Canada. A little three-man fishing boat. He'd go out for 3 days. A big book, a bit of food, and a 45 revolver to kill the sharks when they're trying to nick his salmon. And also to shoot the alcoholic if he got too bad. He goes to a meeting, get a newcomer, takes him on the boat and says, you want to go on a fishing trip? We'll take him out for 3 days. Hope we're really going out in the morning. He got a few sober. He lost two, though. Oh, man. But they're the sort of characters I've met in AA, and there's been plenty of them. And they're still around, they're still here today. I came here 8 years ago, and one of the first people I met was Brian. And Brian myself have been good friends since then. He's crazy as arsehole. That's why I like him. Because I am too. We don't have a crossword yet. Yeah. Yet. And it's marvellous. We don't. I remember for quite a long time you had to sit down, it would appear, and talk about your problems and this and that and the programme. But as time's gone by, I would like if things become a habit, some of it's become a habit. And I don't need today to be divulging every single or question every move I'm going to make, every decision that I can't make. I can sit and laugh and joke and have the crack, as we say. I'm going to tell you one last thing. I come here on my own for the first 3 months to suck it and see whether I was going to take this little job. Tim's on the move, time's up. I don't know, he needs the bathroom. And I went to a meeting in Vinings, and there was a young lady there. I got there early. It was in the old fire station. I won't mention her name, so I'm breaking her limits, but her name was Michael. And she had a cat on her lap with one of these big hoods on, you know. She was a veterinary and she operated on it herself a few days before. And apparently it was a British cat, a British make. I don't know what sort it was, but it had stripes on it, and orange stripes. It looked like a Siamese cat with golden stripes on it. She said, it's a very loving little cat. Anyway, I'm petting it, as you say. And then, of course, they asked me at the end of the meeting if I wanted to stand, and I said, yeah, I said, I'd like to thank everyone for the nice warm welcome. And I said, I've only just met Michael tonight, and she's let me stroke the pussy all evening. I did make a mistake then. It was a genuine mistake. So you have to watch what you're saying. There's probably words that I've said tonight that you totally 100% will misconstrue what I've said. Because I know it happens the other way around. You know, if I've been controversial, I certainly don't give two monkeys. Because I've got to tell it as it is. And there was a service meeting going on when I come in tonight, in that room there. And I haven't done much service in AA since I've been, well, on my own little group. I mean, out of the group, there's so much goes on out of the group. And I've been more involved out of the groups and in the group. And I missed that service. Seeing, you know, the things that need to be done every 5 years, I would say. Everything has to be redone. People have to be re-educated. There's another batch of people coming in, whether it's the medical, the prison officers, whoever it is, there's another batch that know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. Unfortunately, like I started to say earlier, and I calmed it down a bit, the way it's getting diluted to me is they don't know the difference between clean and sober, and there's people in this room that haven't got a clue what the difference is. I'm convinced of it. When I come into AA, he was either sober, he was sober in AA, and he was clean in NA. That's where the delusion is, as far as I'm concerned. We can't be all things to all men. It tells us in the Big Book. Dr. Bob's last talk, he said, let's not louse this thing up. I suggest to anyone go away and read it, because I'm convinced this is what he's talking about, one of the things he's talking about. We cannot be all things to all men. I'm an alcoholic. I've done a lot of drugs. I don't need to bring that into this fellowship. Why did NA start all those years ago? Why do I keep hearing people say, well, I come here because, you know, it's not so big, and there's more. It could be twice as big, well, I can see it, if people only went there. But they won't go. And then I talk to people who have got inferior complexes because they can't take service jobs in AA. Because you have to be an alcoholic. They're not made to feel comfortable in certain meetings. With people like me. What can I do? My son's just come into AA, he never had a drug problem. I was there for him then, and I'm still there for him now. I'd help anybody, and I would direct anybody to NA, CA, whatever it may be, overeaters, and I have done. I get you the numbers. Because you need the identification, not from me. You need your own personal identification. On that note, I'm going to shut up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.